whistleblowers have come forward and I'm collecting their stories. So today what has happened is I had a whistleblower contact me who I've spoken to. I've verified this person. They are working in a home. They have given me their full name. They have given me the name of the home. I'm not yet going to release that to you guys publicly because there's a process that we're going through. But that person has agreed that I can read out what they sent me, and I want you all to know that this is the truth of what is happening. She said, "Hi Claire, thank you for the reply. I'm seeing my manager again tomorrow, and I'm telling her that this will be my last complaint before going to the CQC, which is the Care Quality Commission. But again, I'm not sure how responsive they will be. They don't seem to care. I'm worried that it's my word against all the GPs, the district nurses, and the other carers. What I have to say is that they have put all our residents on do not resuscitate orders, and all of these residents with variable or lack of capacity are on anticipatory care pathways, which means that they are not allowed to go to hospital for any treatment for anything, and they aren't to receive any antibiotics for anything whatsoever, whatever illness they've got. Since this pandemic, in inverted commas, started, we haven't had a single GP visit the patients at our home. Whenever anyone gets ill, and this is ill not related to COVID because we haven't got it in my care home, they automatically put them on end of life. This is now what really gets me, and nil by mouth. And they discontinue all their medication because they say they're at risk of aspiration, which is ridiculous. Sorry. Which is ridiculous. Because if they eat, drink, or have medication, there is a small chance that they could aspirate. But if they're nil by mouth, then they will die from dehydration and starvation. Myself and another carer on nights have had to resort to buying jars of pureed baby food and feeding the residents and giving them drinks after making them aware of the risk of aspiration and getting their consent just so that they can have food and drink. Sorry. Along with this, the GPs are remotely prescribing end-of-life medication, which is morphine and midazolam injections, and these are being misused. All our clients have had their usual medication taken away, which is regular pain relief such as paracetamol and codeine, sorry, and all their anxiety, antidepressant, and antipsychotic medication, which a lot of our clients are on. The district nurses then come into the home to give end-of-life drugs because, with the withdrawal of usual medication, the resident is showing signs of pain and anxiety, which, of course, they would. The morphine should only be used for extreme pain when nothing else helps, and this knocks the individuals out, and especially when they're not eating and drinking and losing weight. This means it's even harder to get any fluids in them. The midazolam is given at end of life for sedation and terminal restlessness and agitation. However, this suppresses the individual's breathing and quickens along their death. No other alternatives of pain relief are given. There's no pain patches, no liquid paracetamol. They just put them straight onto the hard stuff, which, once started, is only a matter of days before that resident passes away. However, this has all been okayed by the doctors and the nurses. And as the need for analgesia is subjective, I don't know how much evidence I can find, or even if I will be believed. But I have collected evidence of fluid charts. I've worked in this home for over 2 years, and I have never seen anything like this when it comes to end of life and just writing people off. I believe it's a human right to have right to life, and they are committing euthanasia. So much for them protecting the vulnerable. You are not allowed to take away somebody's hydration and somebody's pain medication. You are not allowed to. That is illegal. That is wrong. And these doctors and these nurses and these care home staff that are just doing it and aren't speaking out are nothing more than complicit to killing people, to murdering people. And this is really what is going on. This is really what is happening. This is why people are dying and the numbers are high. None of them have got COVID. None of them. The person I spoke to said to me there have been, she can put her hand on her heart and say that two of those people in her home have been murdered. And there's a third that she thinks has, but they, she, th there's other issues that they could question. And she gave me an example and said to me that one of the people in the home got a chest infection during lockdown, and they basically got taken to hospital and they actually got treated. Can't believe it. And the chest infection cleared up. So when they went to hospital, they had a COVID test and it was negative. And then they were discharged because the chest infection cleared up and they had another test and it was negative. And when they got the discharge notes back at the home, it said on it that the person had coronavirus by exposure, despite the two negative tests. And that all usual medication should be removed, and that this person should be put on end of life. This person never had a chance. They didn't have capacity for a start. I would like to see the best interest decision that was made. I would like to see the deprivation of liberty orders that these homes have got in place for people that they're locking up and that haven't got capacity, because you just. You can't do that. You have to get a Dole's order, and the court has to give that. And that the court, you can't get anything from the court. I know that because I know what's going on. So I know that they're not doing this, and it's just murder. It's just killing people, and it's happening. If this is happening in this one small home, and you know what I've been telling you has been happening in my homes, but what has really finished me off today is having to feed these people with baby food. There's one other person at that home that this person works with that is trying to speak out. And yes, the LCP was rebranded, but as I've said, you are not allowed to take away somebody's hydration and pain medication. You can't do that. That's illegal. And anybody that has got a relative in a care home at this time, please. Please, I implore you, if you are able to, go and take your relative out of it. Go and take your relative out of it. I know that many of the staff are perhaps doing the best that they can. I'm sure that they are, but you cannot go along with this. This person that's come out today, it just does not know where to turn to get the people the help that they need. And she is scared about losing her job because if she goes, there is nobody to feed these people. And they are just going to starve to death.
So he was in there, and I've got texts from him. They did not, where he's saying he's so hungry and thirsty, and they weren't feeding him or giving him water. And so on the second day, they tried to put him on the ventilator, and he refused. And I was patched through too. And I said no. And I said, whatever he wants. But he did not want to. He was aware that was dangerous. And then on the fifth day, and I was really sick. I had double pneumonia and 103 fever. And on the fifth day at 10 p.m. of his stay, I got a call from a doctor in the ward saying that my husband was saying he couldn't go on. And I was very alarmed. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, we'll call you back. And so within 2 minutes, they FaceTime me from the executioner's phone. I've got her name and number. And what I saw on the video was my husband sitting up in bed in the hospital gown, and he was awake. His eyes were very drugged. His speech wasn't slurred. And the executioner, the nurse, was sitting on his bed facing him with her moon suit on, with her back to me. I never saw her face. And he said to me, "I'm sorry." And I had no idea what was going on. No one had told me they were going to kill him in a few minutes. And he sounded fine. His lungs sounded fine. He sounded fine. And I said, "Oh, that's okay," like that, because I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, "I love you." And I said, "I love you too." And then they proceeded to give him a cup of water, a cup of soda, a chocolate pudding pop. And he was very happy, because I'm sure that I'm speculating, but that was the first food he'd gotten in 5 days. Then the nurse, the executioner, started speaking into her shoulder and calling for, there were two drugs. I don't know what the first one was, but the second one was morphine. And every 10 or 15 minutes, she would call for more morphine. And I don't know if they injected it. I don't know if they gave it in the IV. I couldn't see. But they did this for an hour and 20 minutes until he died. And he was screaming, doubled over in pain. His head got 10 times the size. And I couldn't believe it, that they were actually executing him in front of me. They didn't even care. And I grabbed my iPad, and I could barely lift my head up because I was so sick. I grabbed my iPad and started taping halfway through. And I have power of attorney too, you know, and they brought in I could hear but not see, a chaplain halfway through, or maybe it was the very end, I don't remember. But anyway, so then they just hung up the phone with me when he was dead. No one explained anything. No one said a word. And that was it. And then they sent me the COVID-19 death certificate. And I mean, I'm still in shock how they could do this. And he sounded fine. And he was 65 years old. He was in great shape. He had no comorbidities. He was a really kind man. And he didn't deserve to die this way, starving to death. And then it wasn't painless. He was doubled over in agony for an hour at least. And he didn't deserve to be executed this way when he would have made it just fine. And he was a good man, and he was calm and patient, and he was a wonderful husband. And so I just hope that there's justice for him, for Christopher Zachary, my husband, for what they did to him.
And the second to the last time I went in to see Vincent, I heard him say to me, "I'm so hungry." And that's the last words I ever heard from him. I actually had some pineapple juice with some liquid ivermectin in it. And I tried to give it to him, but instantly the nurse told me, "You can't do that. He's having trouble swallowing. You can't do that. You can't give him anything."
So he was in an isolation room. He was by himself. They said no family could go up. But I think it was the next day we convinced him to let my brother, who was vaccinated, he could go up, but only for certain hours of the day, certain times of the day, which was amounted to 2 hours. So all day long, Dad was alone. He wasn't fed. They didn't give him food for about 7 to 8 days. And they didn't give him water either. He would tell him he was thirsty. They would bring it in, set it on the table, and not give it to him. He couldn't reach it. So then when my brother would go up, he would give him the water and he would feed him some ice cream. He went without any nourishment and he went without any water. And his doctors would call us. We would call the hospital and we would never get a call back for days. And then when we did get a call back, the doctor was very rude. He was very callous and cold, like we were wasting his time. I said at one point, I wanted to go up there and see my dad and possibly get him out of there. And they threatened me with arrest if I tried. But I should have tried anyway. I should have just did it. I should have took the arrest and got him out of there.
They also would not let me feed her. I asked if I could feed her. I wanted to be the one to feed her because I should, I'm there. But then I was also trying to get her some ivermectin. I brought some with me, mixed it in some applesauce, but they would not let me feed her. So I asked them.
So the ivermectin was just absolutely ruled out. No way, right? No way were they going to let you actually give her something that actually works.
I can talk about it now. I never mentioned that I had it. Said, you know, I got some natural applesauce that, you know, if you're not going to let me feed her, will you please feed her this?
I don't understand. I can't understand why they wouldn't let you feed her. This is very suspicious, very, very dubious, suspect.
Right. So the reason they gave me was they claimed she was too sleepy to eat much. And that if there were any mask problems with her BiPAP, and they also kind of put a fear in me that if she didn't swallow the food before putting that mask back on, it could go to her lungs and cause more damage. So I was a little fearful too, like, okay, well, you guys know what you're doing, you know, and I never thought that they were there to kill her. That was not my thought. My thought was I can trust them. So for me not to feed her wasn't a huge deal at that moment. Right. It's a huge deal now.
Yeah.
So they won't let me feed her. She was also supposed to be getting an inhaler two to four times a day. That never got done. So what I saw there Monday was just unbelievable. I mean, they weren't caring for her like they should have been. There was also a time on Monday where she was just sleeping and she accidentally knocked her BiPAP hose off the BiPAP. And she woke up because the sound difference and I was there and I put it back on. And I had a call for a nurse. I couldn't find the call button. It was nowhere by her. I couldn't find it. So I ended up finding it way behind where Grace's bed was. And I called for a nurse. It's like, one, why isn't that call button by her?
Exactly. And
when I got in the room the next day, which we'll get into that, the call button was nowhere by her again. Like, it was put away from her on purpose. Her cell phone wasn't by her. Nothing was by her if she needed anybody. So this BiPAP getting knocked off, if I wasn't there, what would they be doing? Are you going to just leave her without her oxygen that she needs? When would have you came in the room? I mean, it was at least 5 to 10 minutes before they came to help me, and I'm holding it by her because I don't know if I have it on right.
And the doctor convinced my parents to get Grace on a feeding tube because they weren't allowing me to feed her. They weren't allowing my dad to feed her when he was in there, and the nurses wouldn't feed her. It's absolutely ridiculous. If she would have been fed the entire time, she would have not needed a feeding tube, period. So unknowing that, you know, what was really going on behind the scenes, my parents approved a feeding tube.
The feeding tube was unbelievably a necessity at that point. Because they stopped me from feeding Grace. They stopped my daughter Jess from feeding Grace. And the nurses only fed her a few protein shakes. The fact is, Grace should have been fed the whole time. There was no reason to not be fed. But now she's malnutrition. He wants to put a feeding tube in.
Then from that day, he was on the ventilator for 17 days. They never fed him one time. He hadn't eaten as it was when he was at home for 3 or 4 days. They didn't give him any liquids. They didn't, no water, no food. No vitamins or anything. They just continually kept him on these drugs. I could see how bloated he was, and it was probably because his lungs were full. And this ventilator, they had him on fentanyl. I saw fentanyl on the screen. I just couldn't imagine why they had him on all these painkillers.
What was happening in these hospitals was genocide. They were murdering people in the hospital to increase the death count.
I went undercover. I was a travel nurse in New York during the height of the pandemic. I went undercover because what they were doing in the New York hospitals were essentially murdering people. They were targeting minority populations, the black and brown people, Medicare, Medicaid. I worked at Elmhurst Hospital, which is the epicenter of the epicenter. When I got there, I realized that these people weren't dying of COVID. They were dying of gross negligence, medical malpractice, medical mismanagement. So I ended up going undercover I wore spy glasses. I went through an attorney and I recorded them essentially murdering these patients. They weren't coding full coded patients. They were putting everybody on ventilators knowing that ventilators were killing 100% of these people. And nobody was saying anything. Nurses were making $10,000 a week. Some doctors were making $50,000 a week. Financial incentive is hush.
It always helped them, these Bronx. We can't do bedside Bronx anymore. We can't do Bronx in the bedside with negative pressure even, with disposable Bronch tubes. Nope. No one gets a Bronch when you have COVID. That, to me, is the way we used to treat respiratory patients to the way we're treating now. That is murder. Withholding care is murder when you know better. I didn't know better. I just ate it and abetted. But I ain't going back.
My mom was murdered on October 25th at Baylor Hospital. She was given remdesivir without our authority. We told them specifically not to give her remdesivir. 5 days later, all of my mom's organs shut down. We showed them the studies. Over 30% of the people that were given remdesivir in the studies died. We told the doctor, the infectious disease specialist, do not give my mom remdesivir. Guess what they did? They gave her a 5-day cycle, and my mom is dead. She's dead. She died at Baylor Hospital, tied to a bed with a ventilator stuck to her, taped to her face with her hands tied to the bed because she was ripping it off. They wanted to ventilate my mom as soon as she got there. While she was walking and talking in the hospital, they wanted a ventilator because they get a $39,000 federal funding every time somebody is on a ventilator. And now my mom is dead, given an experimental drug. And so now I have to live with this pain every single day for the rest of my life.
They had Dave on, you know, the face mask, the nose mask. He told me that they, I guess they put that BiPAP on him.
The big one?
Yeah. And he's like, they just put that on me so that they don't have to mess with me. So they don't have to come in and check on me and whatever.
And you know, they give them food and water by any chance?
No. They would bring in, I think, a tray, but it's like they would tell me that when he would eat, the oxygen would go down.
Okay.
You know, so, and it, like I said, he's got all these things hooked up to him, the nose thing, the mouth thing. And it's like, how, he can't eat by himself, like he would need help, you know? So when I would come in there for my hour, there would be a tray there, but it would be full because he couldn't do it by himself. You know, it's like that to me, that's torture, seeing food there and you can't even eat it because you've got all this stuff on you. She's like, you're only allowed in here an hour. And I felt like, lady, if this was your husband laying here, you would want to be here as long as you could be.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing wrong with me being in there. Like, I was not hurting anyone. I was not hurting him. If anything, I was helping him because they weren't. Like, I helped him go to the bathroom before I left because he tells me they don't come in and they don't, you know, check on him. So I helped him go to the bathroom. And the next day, he had a catheter in.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like, again, because you don't want to be bothered by him when he needs to go to the bathroom. And when I was there that day, he asked over and over and over again for ice. My husband loved ice. Even if he's at home, like, he always had ice. And they finally brought it before I left for my visit that day. But it's like, how many times you have to ask for ice? You know, like, he's thirsty. Bring him some ice.
An ER nurse that I was on the back and forth on the bus with, I have this recorded too, the actual police in Queens were bringing in homeless people against their will. And they dose them up with a sedative, pop them up on the floor, pop them up on a ventilator, and collect their checks. Yeah. So, I mean, they've seen these people as disposable, and that's absolutely disgusting.
The propofol, mm-hmm. the morphine, the fentanyl, it's all this deadly concoction that, you know, that some closer comes in, some nurse that they call the closer comes in and offs the patient.
Like, I had to police, actually today, I had to police a resident because he wrote an order for me to run Versed, which is a medicine that you have to be very careful with because it can kill someone at like quadruple the speed of what you should be running it at the dose. And had I not known that, then I would have easily killed the patient and it would have been okay under their COVID standards. So everything is kind of a wash. Nobody's held accountable for anything.
Nobody is listening. They don't care what is happening to these people. They don't. I'm literally coming here every day and watching them kill them. It's like going in the fucking Twilight Zone. Like, everyone here is okay with this. What I need is someone to help me save these people from being killed. Okay? From gross negligence and complete medical mismanagement. Can someone come up with, like, some type of a solution for me? Because I'm kind of out of ideas. You know, when I try and talk with some of the other nurses here, and they're like, well, you can't save everybody. And they all know what's happening. They all agree with me. And they all just shake their heads. And I'm like, am I the only one who is not a sociopath to think that this is okay? They're murdering these people. But these people aren't dying from COVID. Let me give you several examples here. A patient had a heart rate of 40. And the resident started doing chest compressions on him, which is not what you do. You know, I run in there to stop him from doing chest compressions on somebody with a fucking pulse. And then he decides to push epi. He throws some pads on him to defibrillate the guy. He has a heart rate of 40 and a stable bradycardic rhythm. We just need to give him some atropine and pace him. He fucking defibrillates him and kills him. The director of nursing was standing out there and I'm like, can you stop him? He's going to kill that patient. He's going to kill that patient. And the director of nursing just shook his head and I turned around and he killed the dude. Just here, they're just gonna let them rot on the vent. They're medically mismanaging these patients. I'm pretty sure that when you defibrillate somebody with a heartbeat of 40 in a stable rhythm and you kill them, that's murder. And I'm pretty sure that when you put somebody's PEEP up to like 25 and PEEP doesn't go past, I think like 15, 20, and you blow their lungs out and they die, I'm pretty sure that's murder. And I just watched a doctor drop a central line and rupture like the subclavian vein and the guy bled to death. I mean, COVID didn't break that central line. COVID didn't kill that guy.
All of these patients are on ventilators. You know, they're in a medically induced coma, can't speak for themselves, have no, they don't even know they're there. Their IV poles are pulled outside of their rooms. Some of these patients hadn't been touched in weeks. They would have feces all the way up their backs. Like,
oh my God,
that's what I'm saying. There's no family allowed in these rooms. They were banned. Even on good days in hospitals. And I can guarantee anyone that's listening to this that has been in a hospital with a loved one, bad things happen. There's no one in these rooms at that point to hold anybody accountable. It was a free-for-all in a liability-free environment. But that same doctor can go and this happened, and I recorded this multiple times. The same doctor can go and call, order us nurses to stand down and not code a full code patient. So they can, like, these, a full code patient is somebody that wants to be saved. If you don't want to be saved, you have a DNR order, a do not resuscitate.
Right, right.
Majority of the patients, they wanted to be saved. They're, most of them are, you know, young. They were, you know, 30s, 40s, 50, you know, life ahead of them. Full codes. If they stop breathing, we need to resuscitate. If their heart stops, we need to resuscitate. They would order us to stand down and let them die because they were going to die anyway. They were playing God.
So I traveled from Florida to New York. I would say put into the epicenter of the epicenter, Elmhurst Hospital, at the height of the pandemic. okay? What was happening in these hospitals was genocide. They were murdering people in the hospital to increase the death count. So what happened is the rest of the country followed New York's lead, Governor Cuomo, who belongs in prison for crimes against humanity. So what happened, listen, the perfect storm, this is how it happened. They removed all liability from these hospitals. They put financial incentive on COVID patients being admitted. Whether or not they had COVID, it didn't matter. $13,000 to admit. They banned all alternative treatments. The only thing they wanted us to use was ventilators, even though by the time I got there, they knew it was killing 100% of the patients put on a ventilator were killed. 100%.
Everybody that pretty much walked through the emergency room at Elmhurst Hospital, regardless if they have COVID or not, they were getting admitted to the floors. They would be on a ventilator. They would be in a body bag within a month, every single person. Because the hospitals in New York were told, they were ordered to pretty much admit every single patient. There was incentive to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, $13,000 to admit them. If they put them on a ventilator, that's another $39,000.
Oh my God.
And then some of the nursing homes, some of the hospitals rewarded them $10,000 per COVID death, mm-hmm. put them in the freezer truck, and banned all autopsies. So you can't have an autopsy if you're a family member. Sorry, you're just going to have to accept that it was from COVID. 100% of the patients by the time I got there had died. And by the time I left, I had one patient that lived. That's it.
$39,000 financial incentive to put patients on a ventilator. What in God's name is going on? Why would we ever, ever put any financial incentive on a patient in a liability-free hospital? In the meantime, they're paying nurses and doctors extreme amounts of money. $10,000 a week we were making. Some of the doctors were making $50,000 a week. That's hush money. Hush money. I am one of the only nurses in the world speaking out right now. I have had death threats. I have been fired. I have lost my job. I'm blacklisted from nursing probably for the rest of my life. But guess what? I don't want to be a part of a profession that doesn't put people first. People should never, ever come after profit. They should never, ever come after politics. And that's exactly what happened. $10,000 per COVID death in some cases. So they're even giving them financial incentive to have a COVID death. It's disgusting. They banned family out of these hospitals. You had no family. You had no advocates. The only thing that you had was hopefully having a good nurse or a good doctor that cared about you, and it didn't happen. None of my colleagues are speaking out, even though we all knew what was going on. What I ended up doing when I was there maybe like, gosh, a week, I contacted an attorney in New York, and I said, listen, no one's going to believe this. No one's going to actually believe that there are people in our healthcare industry that are okay with disposing of human lives. I didn't sign up for this. This is not what we're taught. As a nurse and a doctor and anyone in our industry, we're mandatory reporters. I'm a nurse, but you know, we're making a lot of change. I went undercover. I videoed them murdering patients. I put it out for the public. That's the truth. People deserve to know the truth. People didn't die of COVID. They died of gross negligence, medical malpractice, mismanagement, and a whole lot of corrupt, greedy politicians that don't care about the people. They care about the narrative. They care about control. For what they did in these hospitals to increase the death count, how much stress do you really have in the medical industry anymore? I have none, and I'm a part of it. I don't want to be a part of this anymore. I'm going to be a part of fixing it, because that's what we need.
Here's the thing, and this is something I have to live with for the rest of my life, because I gave them permission to put her on a ventilator only because I thought that that would be the absolute last resort, you know, but no, they put her on a ventilator that day. And then they called me. The hospital said, you know, she's on a ventilator. I said, she's on a ventilator. I never expected they would have just immediately done that. And my mistake was not ordering them to take her off it immediately. And next thing you know, she's on fentanyl and God only knows what. I've ordered her medical records. I'm in the process of getting her medical records because I want to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, mine is another tragic story, except, you know, my mother was 85, but still, I don't really think she had to die then. This is another example of something very tragic. A 19-year-old girl should not happen. Go ahead, continue,
Scott. Well, your example with your mom is an excellent segue into what I'm going to tell you. So after we denied the ventilator then, and we got wise to ventilators,
yeah,
they asked us four more times, and they did it the same way they did to you. They asked for a pre-authorization or a pre-approval to put Grace on a ventilator just in case. And then how they framed just in case was these type of things tend to happen in the middle of the night when we can't get a hold of the family. Right. So they wanted us to give this pre-approval like you did with your mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were wise to it at then because we thought, well, if we give them the pre-approval, they're going to put her on a ventilator because that's what they do.
You know, when someone is, we're close, we'll pull the code card up and be ready. You know, we're ready. I had the epi ready. That's one of the first things we do. And she wouldn't let me give it. So this was that woman. And the entire time, and this was over his body, his alive body, and we're arguing, and she's laughing, she was smirking. And how this man died was the nurses arguing with the doctors over him as he was dying. And she's smirking the entire time. It was probably one of the worst experiences in my entire life. But all I can think about is that at least he knows that we were fighting for him when he died.
This is wrong. It is straight up it is wrong. And I am 37 years old. I have been in a hospital since I've been 16. Military hospitals that well.
What aspect of it was wrong to you? I agree that there were parts of it that were wrong too. So.
Calling a patient a DNR when there's no order for it and telling us, like straight up telling us, you're not doing anything. That's wrong. If that was my brother or my father or anybody, I would be furious. And I guarantee you, if I called his family right now and told them what happened, they would be furious too.
I flipped. We were all crying. There's a lot of nurses that know that this is wrong, but they're afraid to like say anything publicly.
She said, when I was talking to her, she said, we're not always given the orders. It comes from the top down. And I was thinking, that's my exact problem with everything. Where's it coming from? What's the purpose? Are you guys really trying to kill everybody like everybody thinks?
Within our unit, it was a big fight, and ultimately the kid died with us over his body arguing about this.
The girl's over there.
Yeah.
And the doctors, he's like, the doctor will just write it up that we, you know.
Yeah, I don't trust him though, because I don't know him.
I'm sorry, I'm not doing that.
You mentioned earlier that this is a common occurrence where people come in able to speak and they just have low oxygen levels and then they're put on a vent. What's going on there?
I don't know. I honestly, I have no idea how they're assuming everybody is just the same. There's no individuality anymore. These residents, I think a lot of them are just stone cold. You know, there's no emotion and they don't view people as people anymore. And it's really sad. Like I came a little bit later, you know, after the big rush, but there was still a lot of people coming in and a lot of us were just in shock. Within the first couple days, you could see exactly what was going on.
My bigger problem with this whole scenario is when they intubate people who don't need it.
Yeah.
And it looks very clear to me that they're just pushing it.
You almost feel like you are literally living in the Twilight Zone. and you feel like you're the only sane one in a bunch of insane people. And it's scary because these are the people that others are trusting to take care of them, and they're really doing the opposite.
The doctor put the DNR order on Grace at 10:56 that morning, 8 minutes after they gave her the near-max dose of Precedex. One of the attorneys who reviewed this said they had to get that DNR order in place right away because they thought the Precedex was going to take Grace out.
And I overhear Holly and this two doctors. One of the doctors was Dr. Gavin Shokart, which is the doctor in, that ended up prescribing these lethal drugs and putting an illegal DNR and Grace and all that. I overhear Holly and Dr. Shokart and another doctor.
And I overheard this nurse and two doctors talking in the hallway saying the family is not going to like this.
So you could see on the timeline, I'll just jump to the 10:48. They had her maxed out on the Precedex. It was, we now found out 6 minutes after they upped the Precedex to max, the doctor put an illegal DNR on Grace at 10:56.
And then 11:25, now they give her lorazepam, which is an anti-anxiety drug, which should never be used. A benzodiazepine should not be used with a sedative. Isn't that correct?
Correct. Yep. And so now these three doses of lorazepam here, 11:25, so that would have been the feeding tube time, then 5:46 and 5:49. They snuck all those three doses in.
Yeah.
And then that morphine push, which I don't know anything. Now I know it. If morphine were to be used, not in this situation with Grace, but if it were to be used on somebody, that it's the right actual drug to use, it should have been done in a drip, which is a slow introduction. And somebody monitors the patient bedside with the reversal drug ready to go. None of that happened. I was the only one in the room.
Right.
They literally dosed her and left her and would not step foot in that room.
Right. Now, this IV, when it goes in IV, it's very potent, very potent. This combination of these three drugs is likely lethal for anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
I couldn't have survived it. No
one would have survived this last day. It started at midnight when they started to up the Precedex gradually. 6:45, doctor called. Grace had a good day, just administered morphine to slow the breathing down, which is just rubbish, absolute rubbish.
They gave her this morphine. Holly gave her it in her left arm in the IV and walked out. They left the room. So I peeked my head out and I asked this 14-year ICU nurse, Holly, if I could get a temperature on Grace. I said, she feels really cold. And she said, you can cover her with a blanket. He said, is this normal with what you did? Yep, it's normal. And I even asked them before giving the morphine and stuff, I asked if this was okay to do. And they said that they're going to take her off her anxiety med, the Precedex. I said, is that okay as well to do, you know, and at the same time? And they told me, yep, it's, you know, fine. So anyways, Holly tells me to cover her with a blanket. This is normal. I end up checking for a pulse myself and I can't find one. I check her number on the monitor and it's just slowly dropping down. I end up grabbing, you know, Grace and I lift her eyelid up and her eyes are rolling back. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what to do. So I go and try to get a nurse to come in to help and they won't come in. Holly says to me, we did everything we could for your sister. That was her answer to me.
That combination of meds in that 29-minute window, max Precedex, two doses of lorazepam, morphine, would have taken you and I and anybody listening out. We have over 100 medical professionals that have said this. We have an intensivist who said the combination of meds killed your daughter. The doctor who reviewed all the records with us originally, she even said it's intentional. You can't do this without it being intentional. It's
exactly. So how could you not know? How could they not know that this was going to kill your daughter?
We subsequently discovered that two other things. There had to be a pharmacist who signed off on this. In their computer system, if you put contraindicated meds together, alarms go off. So they had to shut the alarm off. So this is, and a 14-year ICU nurse delivered the meds. So just think it through, people. You know, I'm telling you, it's, you know, I've crossed the line thinking my personal belief is this is intentional. It's genocide.
A nurse reads off the computer that the doctor labeled her DNR, do not resuscitate, and that they couldn't do anything about it. I said, I have my parents here right on FaceTime telling you she's not DNR. She's not DNR. Save her. So my mom's yelling, save our little girl. You know, are you not saving her because she has Down syndrome? My dad's screaming that, you know, reverse what you did. No one, literally no one would help. In this battle, it felt like 30 seconds, but it was a whole 7 minutes that went by. Because at 7:27 is when they said that she died. They called her death at 7:27. The head nurse ends up saying to another nurse there to call it. And at that moment, I don't even know what call it means. I know what call it means now. And there's about 30 to 40 nurses in that hallway. We can say 30 to err on the side of caution, but every single one stood stationary. It did nothing. And when I look at it now, I think they were all clued in on it prior. Only one person, not even one person, move a foot. They literally all stood there. I could picture them way far down in the hallway. In the crowd of probably 20 nurses right out front and, you know, by Grace's door, no one moved. And there's an armed guard posted now. So when I go out to try to get help, there's an armed guard. Holly's nowhere to be found. She vanished. And all these other nurses are doing nothing.
They completely ignored all the warnings.
They let it happen.
They let it happen. Yep. Absolutely. And the nurse that it gave the drugs to Grace was a 14 plus ICU nurse. She knew exactly what she was doing. And I can picture her face. They did this on purpose.
And it showed that disabled females were 10.8 times more likely to die when they're in the hospital with COVID than non-disabled females. I thought, bingo. That is exactly right. And that was only second to elderly being the main cause of death if in a COVID situation. You know, so now you drill that down with lorazepam that you mentioned, and then, you know, then they gave her morphine. Okay, so now in a 29-minute window, she had max dose Presidex, two doses of lorazepam, and morphine as an IV push. So in 29 minutes, all three of those, that would have taken any of us out. Yep. So I believe that this is premeditated murder.
I've been in a third world country hospital in Iraq. The Iraq hospital is better than this one. And that says a lot. I've been there. I've been in both hospitals. And this is in the United States. And this hospital is treating low income, mostly, people, and it almost makes me feel like they think these people are disposable. There was a resident, and I have this on tape. I taped it because it was just so disgusting to me. A 37-year-old, which is my age, was not a DNR. He's a full code. His family in-depth discuss with the doctors that they want us to do everything they can to save him. And he came in talking, he was very terrified. He was just like, you know, totally alert, knew what was going on, and they convinced him to be on a vent. Now he's dead. But the doctor said, when I got into shift, that if he codes, that we are not to resuscitate or try to save him. And we flipped.
This is important. I just asked them if we can put a DNR order, and they said no. That's up to the attending.
Okay, so we're going to code him.
That's what I said, and they said no, we're not. I said, well, yes, we are. Yeah. We're obligated to. So then
we got to say something, though, like it's our license. Unfortunately, you guys got to put in an order. Just something.
That's what I said. Yeah. I said, I'm obligated.
Yeah.
What did she
so
say?
So then she's like, the higher-up said. I said, I don't care what they said.
Yeah. What higher-up? God? We don't have a God here making decisions.
I said, I don't care what they said.
We were just getting on shift because we're starting the night shift at 7. And that was the nurse from the day shift saying pretty much we shouldn't code him if he's going to code. And then I turned my glasses on.
Why are we being told not to code him, essentially? That's what he said. I mean, because I'm going to tell you right now, if he bottoms out, I'm jumping on his chest. If he
period, point blank. It's going to happen.
Okay.
Because until that status is changed in the computer, that's what I'm obligated to do under my nursing license.
Right. I mean,
because you guys aren't going to back me up and protect me.
Well, Elmhurst does have a policy given, like a COVID policy, given their scarcity of dialysis and blood.
It can be a chem code, it can be whatever.
That it's not, there's not a, it's a difference. Normally the standard is whatever the family says, like we just do. So if they would say code them for 5 years, like you just do that.
Right.
So they die. It's a little bit different now because of the new policy in place with our in place, which is that you don't need full family like you can just tell someone that it's medically futile and that we're not willing to just pour blood and resources into something that would be impossible to get back.
Right.
I flipped. We were all crying. There's a lot of nurses that know that this is wrong, but they're afraid to like say anything publicly.
What killed him? Did the vent kill him?
Yeah. Oh yes. They're so sedated. He had probably 8 or 9 drips. It's all sedation. It's all sedation and paralytics. So you are asleep. It is essentially like you're under, you know, you're in surgery, you know, when they put you under like that for a good month straight. There's no way you can recover from something like that.
And they're bringing in a bunch of people from out of town. You got doctors coming in from Nebraska who don't know what the hell they're doing. A lot of people die because of it. I don't know if it's coronavirus or if it was just a breakdown of the health system and we finally scared ourselves to shitless. It's very bizarre and I don't want to comment on it.
So this is the actual letter written on April 6th. And so these doctors are writing that they're asking for these states to give up their lethal injection supplies because they need them for patients with COVID-19. Do they actually use them? So let's go down. I want to show you, these are some screenshots out of the records from this girl that died using these drugs. So you see, they used midazolam, they used fentanyl. Let's keep going down. Now, she went into the hospital on November 17th. She was there 22 days, which is the average hospital stay with somebody with COVID if they get them on remdesivir and a ventilator. She was on everything. I estimated they pulled in $750,000 from her hospital stay. So now you see midazolam, fentanyl. Let's keep going.
Midazolam, fentanyl, and Ventum. Ventum, $2,900 per day, just in maintenance. Wait till they die to get the big payoff.
Well, exactly. And it gets worse. Okay, so now you see midazolam again, multiple. Now they have the verconium, which was also referenced. So, and you see now we go, this is all the day before she died. So they gave her these to take her out. This girl was also put on an illegal DNR, and this is so egregious. So if you look at it, 850, it says the doctor or father states they do not want patient to be DNR. Dr. Fox made aware, planned to speak with family again concerning patient's code status and goal of care. This is what they do. They try to pressure you into this box they want to put you in. Okay, so you look at 850, the father said we don't want to be DNR. Okay, so look at what 13 seconds later, they put her in as a DNR code. They ordered an illegal DNR on her just like they did on Grace. There's thousands of these cases where they put DNRs on people. One of the guys from church told me that when he went into the hospital for COVID, they made him sign his own DNR order as a condition of entering the hospital.
How can you ignore all the warning signs? How can you ignore this DNR? I mean, this clearly isn't your first time doing this. You know what the guidelines are. I do believe that this was premeditated. Seems you know, the audience can decide on their own, but I mean, when you look at the facts and I replay it all in my head and I can see them all standing there stationary and I can see the evil in their eyes. I mean, this 14 plus ICU nurse, I can't get it out of my head. Just pure evil is how I explain those final moments.